You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 28th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Pacific University professor of politics and government, Jules Boykoff, on his book, No Olympians, Inside the Fight versus the Capitalist Mega Sports. In Los Angeles, Tokyo, and beyond. Meanwhile, well over 100 still unaccounted for in the Florida building collapse. 9 now confirmed dead. Mitch McConnell racing to quash the bipartisan infrastructure deal. Meanwhile, record shattered in the Pacific Northwest heat wave. And just in case you felt it had been a while, U.S. bombs Syria and Iraq. Derek Chauvin gets 22 and a half years for killing George Floyd. Joe Biden promises support amid U.S.-Afghan exit. New data shows cuts in extended unemployment benefits have not led to those jobs being filled. HHS revokes work requirements for Medicaid in Arizona and Indiana. Good for them. And lastly, rest in power, Mike Gravel, who read over 4,000 pages of the Pentagon Papers into the record in the Senate 30 years ago. All this, 50 years ago. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Happy Monday. Thanks for joining us at the beginning of the week. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello. I am well. How are you?
I am apparently significantly older than I thought. I was only off by 20 years when the 70s were. So,
time flies.
Time has flown, without a doubt. Wow. That was a little disturbing. But Mike Gravel has passed away. And lived into his 90s and certainly, lived, I think, an impressive life. Left his mark without a doubt on this country. I think it's not too hard to find the video of him reading into the record, the Pentagon Papers. Just as a reminder for people, I think most people know this, but some might not. You have wide latitude as a senator or a congressperson to release documents by reading them into the record. You cannot. You have basically an immunity for whatever you say. On the as long as it's not afoul of the the rules of the House and the Senate in terms of like personal insults and whatnot, but you have wide berth to do these to say these things, and by reading the Pentagon Papers into the record in the Senate, what he did was essentially sort of a de facto declassification. Would you describe it that way, Matt? And made it possible for reporters and everyone else to essentially examine those papers reprint them. They didn't actually reprint the papers. What they did is they reprinted the record that he included into the Senate record. Exhausting, the idea of reading 4,000 pages.
I mean, I think it took him into well into, what, 2 in the morning, something like that.
Oh, it was insane.
Yeah, and he broke down because he lived a life of anti-imperialist, anti-war passion. And I mean, I think that that's how he'll be remembered, as somebody who was not singularly focused, but incredibly focused on, you know, one of the great horrors perpetuated by mega powers like the United States, and, you know, mostly us for the past years. And he was somebody who is, I think, you know, incredibly dedicated in that project, and that's how he will be remembered.
And what was amazing about the Pentagon Papers, it basically allowed the American public to realize that they were sort of getting lies from the the military, in terms of things are going great. And now, if that sounds familiar to you, you might remember the Iraq War, or particularly the Afghanistan War, which now, after 20 years, is we are finally leaving Afghanistan. Here is Mike Gravel. He served as a 2 terms as the senator from Alaska from 1969 to 81, and then ran for president mostly as like a message campaign to push the idea that we should not be in Iraq in 2008 and Afghanistan. Here is a clip of him in 2008, right? This is the Democratic primary. Yes. From 2008. Here's a clip of him during that primary.
Senator Gravel, at a forum earlier this year, I want to get this right. You said it doesn't matter whether you are elected president or not. So then, why are you here tonight? Shouldn't debates be for candidates who are in the race to win the race?
Ryan, you're right. I made that statement. But that's before I had a chance to stand with them a couple, 3 times. It's like going into the Senate. You know, the first time you get there, you're all excited. My God, how did I ever get here? Then about 6 months later, you say, how the hell did the rest of them get here? Yeah. And I got to tell you, after standing up with them, some of these people frighten me. They frighten me. When you have mainline candidates that turn around and say that there's nothing off the table with respect to Iran, that's code for using nukes, nuclear devices. I got to tell you, I'm president of the United States. There will be no preemptive wars with nuclear devices. To my mind, it's immoral, and it's been immoral for the last 50 years as part of American foreign policy.
Let's use a little moderator discretion here. Senator Gravel, that's a weighty charge. Who on this stage exactly tonight worries you so much?
Well, I would say the top-tier ones. Top-tier ones. They made statements. Oh, Joe, I'll include you, too. You have a certain arrogance. You want to tell the Iraqis how to run their country. I got to tell you, we should just plain get out. Just plain get out. It's their country. They're asking us to leave, and we insist on staying there. And why not get out? What harm is it going to do? Oh, you hear the statement, well, my God, the soldiers will have died in vain. The entire deaths of Vietnam died in vain. And they're dying in vain right this very second. You know what's worse than a soldier dying in vain? Is more soldiers dying in vain. That's.
I mean, that aged pretty well.
yeah.
I mean, it was we particularly on a day today where we just bombed Iraq again. And the idea as to whether we stayed in 2009, 2010 in Iraq made no difference whatsoever. What's going to happen in Afghanistan? Very difficult to say that our prolonged involvement in Afghanistan made any difference whatsoever.
I mean, in fact, we very much created a lot more bloodshed.
And It's very hard to argue that we're going to leave them, a year from now when the Taliban ultimately take over, if there's going to be really any measurable difference. I mean, that is the thing, is that,
And in Iraq, we certainly did absolutely nothing except harm. I mean, I think that that can be... there's no stabilization. We've killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and that was, the twin projects he was talking about there. To immense arrogance by Joe Biden, as he said, as he laughs at him. I mean, Hillary Clinton, Obama, they were all laughing at him as he said these, I think, incontrovertibly moral and accurate statements.
Should also say the idea of somebody running for president and not running to win, but rather to carry a message onto the national platform. It's sort of absurd premise to that question that Brian Williams had. Maybe at that time there was, particularly we've seen subsequent to that, half the people run in the Republican campaign as just a way of doing a book launch. To build a two or three year scam.
But they don't say that they're not running to win.
Right.
So the media helps them uphold that fiction as opposed to Gravel being honest about what he was trying to do. It's certainly more noble than what you say, running to increase your chances for higher office, maybe to be, if you're a representative, to be a senator or to get a cushy lobbying job after you leave government or to sell books. I would say Gravel's purpose is certainly more noble than that.
I mean, when we talk about just sheer nobility, I'm not sure that running for as a message campaign isn't a more noble endeavor than actually running to become president in some instances. But be that as it may, rest in power, Mike Gravel. We should say, full disclosure, you did a video for the Gravel Institute.
I did.
I don't know exactly how directly involved.
I didn't paid for it, so I mean, I don't think it's really any.
And I don't know
interest.
If Mike Gravel had any operative aspect of it, but I think there were. But the bottom line is, and folks should check out that video.
Yes, I did. It's on socialism.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Jules Boykoff about No Olympians, side the fight against capitalist megasports in Los Angeles, Tokyo, and beyond. We are only about 3 weeks away from the start of the Tokyo Olympics, which many people feel, and I'm speaking specifically of medical experts in Japan, could be an incredibly disastrous event in terms of COVID. Never mind the implications of Olympics generally, but we will talk to Professor Boykoff about that in just a moment. Couple of sponsors. Late breaking. Pop this up, Matt, because we're going to want people to know. There is we've got some new merch at the merch shop. If you go to shop.majorityreportradio.com, we'll pop that up in a second. Believe me, folks. And we were selling a lot of tank tops, which makes me a little bit nervous. I probably should have made that challenge.
Wow.
Let's get this out of the way first.
No. Summer,
it's summertime.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
What? All right. Is it swamp ass?
Yep.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Living ain't easy if you got swamp ass. You know that, Emma.
I don't think I do, but maybe
generically
do.
Speaking.
Sure.
I mean, not for you personally, but I'm saying in
general. I've heard stories.
Yep. And how are you going to stay on top of your sweaty bottom? Well, a refreshing Hello Tushy bidet. It's stylish. It's eco-friendly. It's super easy to install, and it saves you cheap-ass money. And I got to say, I don't know why they don't include this. Many people think it's far more expensive than it is. Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just clean your butt with a precise stream of water. It cleans itself with the Smart Spray automatic nozzle. It attaches to your existing toilet. You don't have to get a new bidet. There's no electricity needed. There's no extra plumbing needed. It's super easy to install, shockingly easy. And also, I think, I don't know, from the feedback that we've gotten from people assume it's much more expensive than it is. And that's because you can pay $2,000 for a bidet. But this is a great way to, if you are, you know, bidet curious. Hello Tushy has your ass covered with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. If you already got a Hello Tushy, well, treat yourself to the new 3.0 model. And if you're new to the revolution, know that you're joining millions of happy Hello Tushy customers. Folks, I don't know, someone had sent in a clever, like, once you go bidet, you don't go back.
I can't remember what it was. For some reason.
Yeah. Look, defeat swamp ass. Go to hellotushy.com/majority. You get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners at hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. hellotushy.com/majority. Oh, this is exciting. So, I need to get more short sleeve shirts like the one I'm wearing right now. And, but I also wanted some, like, you know, I reserve, obviously, if people watch the show long enough, they know that I have like a rotation of like three shirts and I rotate them through in a very clever fashion. I do that so that we, you know, they don't have to do laundry too much.
It's giving yourself a lot of credit.
Yep. But... And it's true. Well, I needed one for more leisure time. So I ordered two different ones from Stitch Fix. Now, usually the way it works is you get a whole, you know, like a stitch or a fix, like a whole box of stuff that they've picked out. But I wanted something really quick and I knew exactly what I wanted. So I picked out two shirts. Okay. And for many people, shopping is difficult. I am one of those people. Stitch Fix makes it much easier. It offers clothing hand selected by expert stylists for your unique size, style, and budget. Every piece chosen for your fit and your life, you can look and feel your best. And this is what happens. You try it on at home. You keep what you love. You return what you don't. Stitch Fix has free shipping and easy returns or exchanges. A prepaid envelope is included. There's no subscription required. You just pay $20 styling fee for each box, which gets credited toward the pieces you keep. There's no hidden fees ever. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing to fit on any occasion. Women, men, kids, they ship all over the U.S. and available in the U.K. as well. Okay, so I got a fix. I got a space dye polo from Carson, light gray, okay? And I figured this slam dunk. And then I also figure I'm going to try something that's a little bit outside my comfort zone, which was a seersucker short sleeve shirt, okay?
That's the one you've been wearing.
And they show up, and I didn't like the polo. The Heather Gray wasn't heathered enough for me.
Okay.
But I did keep the other one, and everybody in the office said it was very slimming.
Yes.
And so I kept the seersucker. It took me about 30 seconds to put the gray one back into the envelope. I just went back on the site, return, boom, done. Whole thing done.
Ugh. That's so nice when they make it so easy to return.
So yeah. Easy. And now, and the thing I like about it is, like, I've expanded my sartorial repertoire. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing to fit any occasion. And it's available in the UK. They ship. Check it out. Get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. And lastly, I am a very habitual person. I think it's pretty evident, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there is nothing like, you know, sort of like things that are casual and you can do on a daily basis, things that maybe are under the surface. What am I talking about? I'm talking about Third Love's bras. Now, I don't wear bras.
Yes.
So I don't have a sense of this, but...
I will say I am wearing a Third Love bra today.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
Third Love's, then you know.
I know, yeah.
Now, Third Love has some limited edition summer styles. They are designed with tropical-inspired colors, vacation-ready designs, and breezy feelings that whisk you away to your own personal paradise. Plus, you can also, Third Love has not only perfectly fitted bras, but they also have quality sleepwear. Check out Third Love to find your new favorite everyday essentials, from their new feather lace collection to their number one rated 24/7 classic t-shirt bra. My daughter is constantly harassing me for new bras. From Third Love. She loves them.
Oh, well, no, I mean, they really are. It's a really unique service, and it's very helpful.
And this is the thing. They have that simple fitting room quiz. It factors in your size, breast shape, current fit issues, and your personal style to find the perfect bra and underwear for you. If you have any questions, they have fit stylists that are available for one-on-one chats. Their perfect fit promise means if you don't love it, you exchange it, and returns are free. And so far, Third Love has donated over 40 million in gently used return bras to women in need, supporting charities in their local San Francisco Bay Area across the U.S. Like I say, I am not a bra wearer, but our bra trier honor wearer, number two at the Majority Report, we've actually had two different ones. The idea that I had 60 days to try out the bras drew me in. But in the end, I don't think I've ever had a better experience buying clothing online. Certainly not when it comes to bras. The fit finder worked like a charm. The choice of styles, amazing. Both bras I ordered were a perfect fit. They are incredibly comfortable and cute and subtle. That doesn't even include my daughters. So we actually have three, I guess. You deserve some TLC. That's Third Love Comfort. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now. Get 20% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 20% off today. Check it out, folks. Meanwhile, do we have that picture? All right, pop up this picture of the of what we've got at the we not only not have what do you call it, the tank
tops. Already up on the site.
We already have on the site. Oh no, it's Sam Cedar. What an effing nightmare shirt. There it is. That's the back. What an effing nightmare. A little my like little top, really basically my forehead is there. And show the first half again. Oh, no, it's Sam Cedar. And, of course, it's a quote. It's a quote from Steven Crowder. We don't attribute it to him because, really, I'm not going to lie. He's not the first person to say that in regards
right.
to me.
Right. Well, I mean,
different context. It's usually at parties.
Also, it's just for pure branding purposes. We don't need Steven Crowder's name on our
exactly.
merch.
Exactly.
We used him to humiliate him for the merch.
This is, once you go bidet, there's no other way. That's what someone just said.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yep.
But in terms of this, check it out. Quality, everything, of course, that we have, union-made, American-sourced, quality T-shirts. We have our guest. We good? Yep. Joining us now on the program, Professor Pacific University professor of politics and government, the author of No Olympians: Inside the Fight Against Capitalist Megasports in Los Angeles, Tokyo, and Beyond, Jules Boykoff. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Thanks for having me.
So obviously we're 3 weeks out from Tokyo. There's a whole nother sort of set of issues regarding the Tokyo Olympics because of COVID, but in many respects, the relentless, insistence on having these games when you have some of the top medical experts in the country saying this is a bad idea, the same forces are creating that dynamic in addition to all the other issues that exist with the Olympics. So let's start with just sort of the history of the games and the problems with the games. And we should say, this is not about the athletes per se, right? This is about everything else that comes with it.
Absolutely. That's a great place to start, really, because there's no question that athletes are what make the Olympics what they are. Were it not for the athletes, there'd be no Olympics. But then you have this group of people from the International Olympic Committee who are the organizers of the games, who essentially use athletes like human shields to create these monstrous events that do incredible damage to the communities that host the events, whether it's Tokyo, whether it's London, whether it's Vancouver, or whether it's a future host like Paris or Los Angeles. And so the longer history of the Olympics really does help us make sense of this when you go all the way back to the beginning of the games and think that they were started by a baron, an aristocrat from France named Baron Pierre de Coubertin, who got together a bunch of other barons and dukes and counts and really created this elite affair. And ever since then, the Olympic chorus has sung with an upper class accent, and it definitely does that today. And that explains a lot of what happens and why it might not make sense to your listeners and viewers why we're pressing ahead with an optional sporting spectacle during a global health pandemic. Well, if you think about the fact that it's elites with money on the line, including the International Olympic Committee and NBC, which is hosting the games here on the broadcasting networks of the United States, then it starts to make a little bit more sense.
And we should say, full disclosure, this program replays on the Peacock app. I think the Peacock app is carrying a lot of the Olympic games. We're not owned by NBC, but we do provide them content through a licensing deal. Full disclosure, that's there. All right. So let's talk. I mean, how much money are we talking about? Like, I mean, how much money in when it's, we're talking about an extraordinary amount of money, and then lay out for us the different sort of cohorts of people who are getting that money.
All right. So for starters, the Olympics are an extraordinarily expensive affair. And there's this dynamic, what I call etch-a-sketch economics, whereby during the bid phase of the Olympics are only supposed to cost this much. You put it on your etch-a-sketch. You say, hey, public, look, it's only going to cost, in the case of Tokyo, $7.3 billion. But then once you actually get handed the Olympics by the International Olympic Committee, you shake up that etch-a-sketch, write a brand new number on it. In this case, in Tokyo, we're looking at $30 billion being spent on the Tokyo Olympics. Now, that's just to get the games to happen.
By whom? Who spends that money?
All but $6.7 billion of that $30 billion is public money, which is to say taxpayer money. And that's pretty par for the course, to be honest. When you look at most Olympic games, they're essentially purchased by the taxpayer, and they're there for corporations to kind of come along and make money off them. That's the general dynamic that undergirds them. So who's going to make the money? That's another one of your elements of your question. Well, for starters, the broadcasters of the Olympics, they stand to do quite well. The International Olympic Committee as well. They've got more than $1 billion in their coffers, their reserves at all times. And so we're talking in these games, around $5 billion or so in broadcast revenues will be distributed to the IOC and other entities. They like to tell us that they spread them around to the wider Olympic movement. That's what they call it, the Olympic movement. But a really important study out of Ryerson University found recently that compared the amount that actual Olympic athletes get from the revenues of the Olympics to other sports, like from the NBA or the National Football League, National Hockey League, or the English Premier League of soccer, football in England. And they found with those other leagues, the athletes get around 45 to 60% of the revenues that are brought in by their sport. With the Olympics, it's only 4.1%, 46 to 60 or 45 to 60 compared to 4.1%. So the money does not necessarily go directly to athletes. And that's why you're seeing a lot more athletes starting to organize in the Olympic space. People from track and field, people from swimming, starting these organizational bodies that kind of resemble independent unions that are trying to fight back and claw back some of this money, because it tends to go to the International Olympic Committee and well-connected political and economic elites in each host city.
And how much of this, you know, capitalist driver is part of why we see the Olympics move from city to city, which has devastating effects on the infrastructure, the houseless population, et cetera, people who don't have the resources and who are forced out of areas where there's just this enormous amount of construction and building that just goes by the wayside, you know, once these temporary events are done?
Yeah, that's such a great and important question. So for starters, if I may just say that no matter where the Olympics happen, there tends to be at least four negative externalities, downsides, negative underbellies of the Olympics. And that is overspending, which we've talked about. That is the displacement and eviction that you're talking about there. There is the greenwashing that is endemic to the Olympics as well, talking a big green game, but not actually following through. And then there's the militarization of public space around the Olympics. It's become such a large spectacle that local security forces basically use it in order to get all the weapons that they'd ever want to get and special laws to suppress dissent during that they'd never be able to get during normal political times. So why don't we just put it in one place, for example? I think it's kind of ghosting behind your question there, Emma. And the answer is exactly what you're talking about. Capital accumulation. The International Olympic Committee is this band of peripatetic elites that definitely don't want to keep it in one place. That's part of the fun for them. also with the corporate sponsors, who, by the way, give about 18% of all revenues to the International Olympic Committee. They use the Olympics as a way of grooming potential hires down the line, partying with their friends and that kind of thing. Why would they want to give it up and have it in the same place, like boring old Athens or something like that? Sometimes people will suggest Athens, even though it's not clear that actually the people of Athens would even want the Olympics after the debacle of 2004, where they way overspent and you have a herd of white elephant stadiums sitting there unused. And so I think to really directly answer your question, it's because of the International Olympic Committee has no interest in anchoring it somewhere. It's much more fun to zip around the world with all of your IOC members. I'll just say, as a sort of counterpoint to the fact that the athletes barely get anything, if you're on the International Olympic Committee's executive committee, their board, you get $900 a day in per diem only. That's not to mention the five-star hotels, everything else. You're stacking up $900 a day for just sitting in the crowd, maybe snoozing away the afternoon watching a sport. So that is because of all that, you've seen this real rise and descent against the Olympics. In Tokyo, we're definitely seeing it. Some 80% of the population plus don't want the Olympics this summer. But it's even beyond Tokyo because of the problems that you're alluding to.
So, and when we talk about, I mean, when you're explaining, like, you know, the amount of public funds that go into this and how the NBC in this instance gets $5 billion, you know, the public spends $35 billion essentially. NBC gets $5 billion. I would imagine you have a tremendous amount of real estate interests that are local, but who knows what relationships they have with other, you know, real estate. They're making hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars as well. It just reminds me of like my daughter's business that she got going, which is I buy her clothes. She sells them on Depop and she thinks that she's, you know, some type of business mogul. And I'm like, it's just a transfer of money. I'm just giving you money. You're just going through the exercise of selling the money I gave you for maybe a little bit less money. And then you're just pocketing it. And that sort of feels like what this is. Even before we get into all of the sort of ancillary ills that it creates and displacement that it creates, that and essentially scarring of the development of cities that it creates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I hadn't quite thought of it like that before. You know, I'm talking to you from Portland, Oregon, and just up the road from where I live in Vancouver in Canada, I interviewed an activist there back in 2009 called Am Johal is his name. And he said at the time, he said, the Olympics are a corporate franchise that you buy with public money. And I think that's kind of underneath what you're saying there. It's a corporate benefit to the Olympics, but it's bought with public money, or in the case of your family, with your money. And that money that the corporations benefit from, that doesn't stay in the local community. That gets leaked out to these corporate sponsors who are worldwide corporate sponsors. I mean, we're talking about like Airbnb, Coca-Cola, Alibaba, these international firms that are leaking the money that they make out from their pole position at the Olympic Games. And so more and more people are waking up to this. And that's why the Olympics are having a harder time locating in particular cities, because nowadays, whenever some elites in a city decide to put a bid forth, you basically have a bunch of activists standing up saying, wait a second, we heard about these Olympics. Now, to your point about developers, you're absolutely right. They stand to benefit massively. Let's just again look at Tokyo for a second, since that's on everyone's horizon here. And when they built the new national stadium for the Olympics in Tokyo, they actually had to adjust the local laws, because previously you could only build up 15 meters. It was an old imperial law, so you didn't dishonor the empire. Well, when they wanted to build this national stadium, it was going to be 80 meters tall. And so they actually had to change the law. Well, who benefited from that? Again, well-connected developers who could build up with the structures that they already owned and stretch more rent out of their spaces that they own. And so again, this is a corporate franchise bought with public money, as Am Johal said way back in 2009.
And just to be clear about that dynamic, because I think this dynamic takes place in its own unique way, depending on what city it is. It's a form of disaster capitalism, essentially, like, right? Like, this is a unique situation. So we're going to change the laws, but the application of that change of the laws, which is necessarily favors capital at that moment, that continues on. That legacy lives. This is a way of us to change the laws because of this special situation that we've created a capital is created, essentially, that will ultimately allow capital for years to come to take advantage of.
Exactly. In fact, back in 2013, I wrote a book called Celebration Capitalism and the Olympic Games. What I talk about is celebration capitalism is basically a 1-2 punch with Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism. It just happens in celebration conditions, notwithstanding everything I was just talking about all those downsides. The Olympics are tremendously popular so long as they're not happening in your city. And so in that moment of celebration, all these elites can get all these special laws, all these security officials can get all these weapons that they'd never be able to get during normal political times. It's just in a celebratory atmosphere instead of the state of exception being a negative one, as with Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism. Exactly.
And it's, I mean, necessarily when, I mean, these games are not going into places where there's no people, right? And they are displacing people. They are upending communities. And necessarily it's going to do so. It's like water travels, you know, downhill. They're going to go to the place where there's the least amount of political resistance, which is almost always a function of basically people who are living in low income or poor areas who don't have the political power to push back, even if they are just as inclined not to want the Olympics there as anybody else.
Absolutely. In fact, often what we see with the Olympics is that it targets public housing. I was in Tokyo with the great sports journalist Dave Zirin. We were writing stories for The Nation magazine back in July 2019. And we interviewed two women who were displaced by the 2020 Olympics from public housing. They were also displaced by the Olympics in 1964 in Tokyo, the same women. I mean, incredible story. So the Olympics tend to decimate public housing, and it's not just a Japan thing. In the United States, in Atlanta, 1996, huge public housing communities were destroyed to make way for the Atlanta 1996 Summer Olympics. And so, yes, this is definitely one of those central dynamics, displacement. You look at China and what happened when Beijing hosted the 2008 Olympics. 1.5 million people were displaced to make way for venues. That's breathtaking. 1.5 million. I lived in Rio de Janeiro in the lead up to and during those Olympics. I had the good fortune of being a Fulbright research fellow then. And I worked with communities that were also displaced and decimated. Some 77,000 people, 77,000 displaced from their homes in Rio de Janeiro to make way for Olympic venues. And behind every one of those 77,000 people is a human with a story. And I just got to interview tons of people and hear about the sad elements of getting displaced and their lives were destroyed by these Olympics. And this is just what happens in every single Olympics. The general trend, I would just say in closing on the displacement, is that with the global South, it tends to be more forced eviction and just good luck to you. In the global North, it's more like gentrification and displacement. So with the upcoming games in Los Angeles, what we're seeing is areas that are going to host the Olympics are already being gentrified, and it's just going to get turbocharged by the games and pricing out people, moving people to the periphery, if not to being in unhoused status.
Let's talk about LA. This is the focus of your book, at least in terms of like the activism in fighting against these games. This much of it centers around DSA. Talk about the how the activism is constructing itself into fighting these games, and maybe give us a little bit of history of how these games were introduced. I think it was 84 was the last set of games in LA. Just give us a little background as you wind into how the activism is building itself in opposition to these games.
Absolutely. So you're right. Los Angeles hosted the Olympics twice before, once in 1984 and once in 1932. In 1984, a lot of people that study the Olympics point to it and say, hey, at least they didn't hemorrhage tons of money. They did spend more than they said they were going to. But at the end, they did have a little bit of a surplus, about $200 or so million. And so people point to that and say, oh, look, success. They didn't just lose all this money. There was some tremendous downsides to those Olympics. So when I was in Los Angeles, I interviewed a lot of people that were around in 1984. And I noticed right away that memories of 1984 Olympics are classed and they are racialized. If you're a person of color who's not rich in Los Angeles, there's a very good chance that you do not remember those Olympics with total fondness. If you're a white person who is relatively affluent, then you tend to look at those games and think, wow, how wonderful they were. And it it was because of people like the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, and a sort of media baron by the name of Casey Wasserman, who were there in 1984, two white men, I should point out, that did have a great time. And they wanted to bring the Olympics back to Los Angeles. And so when they did, they were met by serious activism. And so my book, No Olympians, chronicles the rise of two political forces, anti-Olympics activism globally, as well as the rise of democratic socialists of America, the United States. It also declines the, it also looks at the decline of interest in the Olympics. And it all kind of comes together in Los Angeles, where you've got this really smart, savvy group of activists that came out of the Democratic Socialists of America's Housing and Homelessness Committee. And they're talented, they're creative. They bring in actors and comedians like James Adomian and Kate Berlant to play a part in their activism. And they play kind of an inside-outside game. I was down in Los Angeles when they were testifying at City Hall, but they're also on the streets and they're organizing in this huge coalition across the city from Black Lives Matter LA to the Los Angeles Community Action Network to all these other various groups in town. And it's really interesting what they're doing right now and doing all sorts of creative activism along the way.
I mean, talk about that, that notion of, I don't know if intersectionality is really the word in this, but there is a, it seems analogous to the social justice movement in unionism that we're seeing in some places, where there is a broader portfolio of issues than, at least in the context of this unionism, than what is facing directly the union at any point. It is both a mechanism to fight the specific issue you're fighting with, but also to build broad alliances locally to strengthen everybody's sort of particular issue set so that you're actually making a movement.
Yeah, I really like that way of looking at it. Basically, the Olympics are this monstrous juggernaut that when it rolls into your city, you've got all these activist groups that are already working on their various issues, whether it's housing issues like the LA Tenants Union are working on in Los Angeles, and gentrification issues, whether it's policing issues like Stop LAPD Spying. They're already working on these issues. And then what you need, though, is sort of an activist hub to bring them all together, to work together as a coalition and use the Olympics as a way of focusing energy on all of their campaigns. So everybody really benefits. I mean, the Olympics do generate a lot of social attention. It's a great way of grabbing people's attention, especially if they consider themselves to be apolitical, but they like sports. And so you can start a real political conversation by talking about the Olympics and then bring it down to these issues that you care about. And what I noticed over time in working in Vancouver, I lived in London during the Olympics and before the Olympics as well, is that it does bring together these interesting coalitions that tend to stay together and fight together after the Olympics as well. And so that's what's really interesting to me about the Olympics, is that they often talk about having these great legacies that they leave behind. And a lot of times they're just hocus pocus, the actual legacies. But one of the real legacies that they inadvertently may leave behind is these activist groups that continue to fight together after the games are gone. Because, you know, before what we've seen in the last year or so, which is a transnational movement, prior to that, fighting the Olympics was essentially a game of activist whack-a-mole. Like, it would pop up in the city, the security forces and locals would try to tamp it down, and then the games would be over, and then they'd stay down, and then the next city would come up, and it would pop up in the next city. What DSA LA and the No Olympics LA group that emerged out of DSA LA is trying to do is create more of an international movement, and they've been successful. They had the first ever transnational activist anti-Olympic summit in Tokyo in 2019, where you had activists from all around the world come and share strategies. And that takes the moment of anti-Olympics activism and tries to turn it into a movement that has legs to move from city to city through time. That's what they're trying to do. And the people in LA are at the forefront of that right now.
How much is, anti-capitalism motivate the anti-Olympics protest, and how much is it that it just so happens that the Olympics are a really good manifestation of things that are problematic about capitalism?
Right. I mean, the way we were talking about the Olympics before, it's essentially an example of trickle-up economics to benefit the rich. And so it gets a lot of activist groups fighting against it. I think in terms of the amount of anti-capitalism that you see, very much depends on the city. in Los Angeles, there's a lot more people that are talking about capitalism and bringing it into discussion, which makes sense since it's DSA LA that's kind of at the lead there. Other cities, it's not so much. It really very much depends on the city. You know, one of the things about the Olympics, though, is that it can bring together activists from across the political spectrum. And I want to take us all the way back to 1976 to an Olympics for Denver. You might be thinking, Denver Olympics, 76? I don't remember that one. That's because it never happened, because activists across the political spectrum stood up and said no. So they were given the Olympics in the early 1970s. And then people that are fiscal conservatives are like, we're spending money on what? Like, that doesn't make any sense in terms of the way we see the world. You had all these left activists in the environmental sphere come together and say, we're going to destroy our mountains. We're going to Californicate Colorado. That was one of the slogans, don't Californicate Colorado. And they actually came together, these two groups, got a ballot measure on the ballot, Colorado, a wide vote, and they said no to the Olympics. We're not going to give you any money. And so the International Olympic Committee was forced to move those Olympics to Innsbruck, Austria. So it's one of those weird things, the Olympics, where it can actually bring together people across the political spectrum to say no to the games.
It really is, I think, like a such a perfect example of like full-on, pure Mount Pelerin style neoliberalism, right? Where it's where it really is like ostensibly a private enterprise on some level, but it is so much just a direct semi-direct transfer of public wealth essentially to private hands. And then on top of it, there's huge social costs that are completely sort of socialized, whereas all of these private profits are taken by the same sort of group of people. Sometimes they open up the doors and it's like, yeah, we're going to give some to the local versions of us, and then we're just going to move on to another locality. I mean, it really sort of impressive in that respect. So let's talk about the at least in the context of LA, where are we in the trajectory of this fight against the Olympics, and what are its prospects at this point?
Right. So initially, Los Angeles was bidding on the 2024 Summer Olympics, and they were up against other U.S. cities. So the United States can only put forth one city to go for it in the international battle to get the games in 2024. Los Angeles was going against Boston. The United States Olympic Committee gave it to Boston. People stood up in Boston and said, hell no to the Olympics. They fought back against it to the point where it was just untenable for the mayor of Boston and elected officials to do it. So they pulled out Boston after being granted the bid. And then LA stepped in and said, okay, yeah, we'll take it. And they were in the running for the 2024 Olympics against a bunch of cities, including Paris. But they started dropping out one by one by one, all these cities, for all the reasons that we've been talking about today. And that only left Paris and Los Angeles fighting for the 2024 Olympics. This is back in 2017. And the International Olympic Committee decided to do sort of a Hail Mary move by assigning both the 2024 and 2028 Olympics at the same time. Now, they said, of course, the International Olympic Committee did, that they had all these great bids and they just want to make sure everybody was happy and so on. But the reality is all these activist movements around the world that had scuppered these bids, leaving only Paris and Los Angeles standing, put the International Olympic Committee in this sort of position of desperation. And they assigned the 2024 Olympics to Paris and the 2028 Olympics to Los Angeles. Now, usually in the recent era, the assignation of the games, the assigning of the games to the time they're delivered is 7 years. But in the case of Los Angeles, because of this sort of fancy move they did, it was actually 11 years. So for starters, a lot can happen in 11 years. And we've already seen a ton happen. And coronavirus has really opened our eyes to what can happen really swiftly like that. But it also created opportunity for activists in Los Angeles to organize over a longer period of time and to figure out how they might like to strategize against the Olympics, since they had actually an additional 4 years. And so that kind of what brings us to this present moment of Los Angeles fighting hard against the Olympics, and the Olympics really having their shine taken off them by this debacle in Tokyo, and the way that the International Olympic Committee has rammed ahead and made it very clear to the entire world that people in Japan have no power to cancel the games, even if they wanted to. I mean, the prime minister of Japan stood up in front of the cameras and said, I couldn't cancel the games even if I wanted to because of a provision in the host city contract that all host cities sign, including Los Angeles, that says that the International Olympic Committee has the ultimate power to cancel the Olympics. And so all this is really helping anti-Olympics activism as you see what's happening, the selfish way that the Olympics are unfolding in Tokyo.
Yeah, and I should say that that's also absurd in terms of, I'm quite convinced the Prime Minister of Japan could make it much more cumbersome for the Olympics to come. But what I think is interesting about the implications of that longer timeline and what you write in the book about internationalizing this, like the analogy, you know, when I was in college, I did, you know, school activism. I mean, broader activism too, but within the school. But the problem was that you had like a 4-year window and then you had a completely different population. So there was no institutional memory. It sort of feels like that is, you're building, or I should say the No Olympian movement is building an institutional memory that is both, that both exist temporally and spatially.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And that is exactly what they're trying to do. Take the moment of anti-Olympics activism and change it into a movement that has that kind of historical memory, that knowledge transfer. And that's really what that anti-Olympics summit in Tokyo in July 2019 was about. Were it not for the coronavirus, there would probably be yet another international anti-Olympic summit this summer at the Olympic Games. And so it'll be interesting to see moving forward how they take that transnationalism and convert it into solidarity and activism around the world against the Olympics.
You're talking about organized activism with DSA on the ground when it comes to opposition to the Olympics. I just wanted to return to the athletes organizing because that's a fascinating dynamic in and of itself. Like, for a lot of these specialized sports, this is the peak of what one can achieve, as opposed to, say, as you mentioned, like the NBA and the NFL. You can make a lot of money playing in a league every year, being at the top of your sport. That 4% figure is staggering. What, you know, how is that pay structured? One, do, say, you know, swimmers or basketball players get paid more because that's a more popular sport than archery or whatever it is in the Summer Olympics? And what how much money really is made?
Mm-hmm. Great questions. And, you know, you raise the really vital point that basically not all Olympic athletes are created equal. You'll have these superstars rolling in from the NBA and the WNBA who are doing fine economically. They don't need the Olympics. They don't need the $37,500 you get from the United States if you win a gold medal, for example. But then you have athletes from lesser known sports, say fencing, where you actually had an athlete who she started a GoFundMe page because there was really no other way to make it work. And so a lot of these athletes from the lesser known sports, just like you say, the Olympics are their one chance to sort of make a break, maybe even just break even because they went into debt to try to realize their Olympic dream. And so canceling the Olympics for them is no small thing. It leaves them in a pile of debt. Whereas for some of these bigger name athletes, it's not as big of a deal. I don't want to minimize, you know, what they might be going through if they really had an Olympic dream. But it's interesting when you look at some of the athletes who've actually been outspoken, wondering aloud, should we have these Olympics? They tend to be the financially insulated athletes, like from tennis or from basketball, that are like, are you sure we should be doing this in a global health pandemic? Naomi Osaka, the great Japanese tennis great, who actually wondered aloud recently if the game should happen. It looks like she might now be participating. We'll see what happens there. But yes, the other thing about this is that some of these big name athletes that don't worry about the money side, they might actually be the people that engage in athlete activism at the Olympics this summer. I mean, we're living in this extended Black Lives Matter moment, this extended Me Too moment that has definitely played a huge role and had ramifications in the world of sports. And you have a lot of athletes who are fired up politically right now. We might call this the age of athlete empowerment. And so that could be one of the positives if the Olympics look like they're going to happen this summer, and they might, that we might have a number of engaged political athletes using the medal stand as a way to launch more discussions about justice in this world.
How are the LA activists and the Tokyo activists, how are they integrating and what are they doing like literally and tangibly to sort of build for, I guess, the next one is Paris. I mean, are they basically focused on Paris? Are they doing Winter Olympics? I mean, what are they doing to create this movement and sort of, I would imagine, create some type of like templates so that local activists know what to do? We don't have to reinvent the wheel each time.
Right, exactly. And so they are creating ways of sharing knowledge. There's weekly calls, I know, between the transnational activists where they're sharing ideas and talking about the campaigns that they're working on. They just had this really big campaign called No Olympic Day that was very successful in terms of getting people out in the streets in Tokyo, getting people out in the streets in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles and other places around the world. They also use social media to really ramp up other people being able to know about it. So they have these weekly calls that they do, these actions that are coordinated. They are also talking to people around the Beijing Olympics. So to your question, yes, it is also involving Winter Olympics. I mean, let's not forget that the Olympics are really in a bit of a slow motion crisis right now. It's not just the debacle in Tokyo that's unfolded in really unpredictable ways, but in only a few months' time, like around 7 months or so, we'll have the Olympics in Beijing, an obvious human rights violator. And so the International Olympic Committee is just trying to get through this crisis and on to Paris, where there's a very fervent group of anti-Olympics activists who are occupying space, for example, in community gardens there that'll be decimated for the Games and engaging in all manner of other practices. And yes, they're in constant communication, this sort of transnational unit.
So, at the end of the book, you give a sense of what can be done here in terms of the Games. Let's talk about those. I mean, you frame them as reforms, and I guess presumably the DSA, at least to a large extent, is interested in sort of some form of radical change. Like, where. Talk about the specific reforms that you espouse, but also that relationship between reform as opposed to, the Olympics as a surrogate for capitalism and what DSA's agenda might be there.
Yeah, well, there's tension between what I suggest in the book, and I acknowledge that in the book, and what the activists from DSA LA, No Olympics LA want. Let me be very clear. No Olympics LA is an Olympic abolition group. So they want to abolish the Olympics. They want to abolish the International Olympic Committee. And No Olympics Anywhere is one of their primary slogans. So you might say it's like a non-NIMBY approach. You know, they don't want to be Olympic NIMBYs and just say, not in our backyard, but someone else can have it. Sure. No, there are no Olympics anywhere. Now, I can agree with that in principle. I think that the International Olympic Committee has done all manner of horrible things. And we didn't even get into the corruption behind the Olympics. There's actually huge corruption allegations behind these Games, maybe another time. But, you know, so I'm hugely critical of the Olympics and have been for around a decade plus. But I also see the International Olympic Committee's power. And so I try to engage in sort of a constructive way about things that they could possibly do to make the Games a little bit more just for everyday working people in the Olympic city. And, you know, a couple of the things that I suggested was, one, take all the Olympic villages that are built. So every time there's an Olympics just about, they build a special Olympic village where the athletes stay during the Games. Take that and convert it into some manner of social housings for people that actually need housing. I mean, Los Angeles is a perfect candidate for this. I know they're going to try to use the dorms in USC and UCLA, but were they to build an Olympic village? Why not help the unhoused population, which is enormous in Los Angeles? So have an actual positive social function for the Olympic Village. I also say, well, they just need to be accountable. I mean, the International Olympic Committee is one of the largest sport infrastructures in the world, and yet one of the least accountable. There just has to be some kind of anchor point that pushes back on them when they don't follow through with their promises, which is basically every 2 years when they have an Olympics. And so trying to think about creatively how to do that, maybe with their partners at the United Nations, who they do a lot of spectacle promises with, but don't actually have, they don't, the UN doesn't really have a lot of power behind them, but I think they could be a group that could impose some legibility on the process. And finally, give more power to the athletes, especially now as they're getting more and more organized in all these different sports. Let them have more control of the Olympics. There is no reason why the International Olympic Committee should have an honor member by the name of Henry Kissinger. He is an honor member of the IOC. So he can show up at the Olympics, you know, sleep away the day in the gymnastics competition, collect his money for his per diem, and then head on his merry way. We're talking about one of the biggest human rights ogres in the history of the world. And he is an honor member of the International Olympic Committee. So you could just start by scraping away all the detritus out of the IOC as well and probably go pretty far. So there's a lot to do. Don't get me wrong. Those are a few places I think we could start.
Well, what about the idea of finding a designated place in the world that becomes like, this is where the Olympics are. We've got one in the summer, one in the winter. We're not going to rebuild this every time. This is where it's going to exist. Maybe there might be, you know, some economic activity that builds up around it. But we just, I mean, I don't know where this place would be. But why couldn't that be the case where the level of displacement, the and that, let's say, the money that supports the development of this, obviously, by year, by the second go round is less, right? You just need to keep up that it actually is spent by the people who are profiting off of all this, as opposed to sort of just sucking both resources and the vitality of a city out of a city. And giving it to these interests.
Eminently sensible, and that makes it probably impossible to do within the Olympic sphere. I mean, I think Emma was getting at this a little bit earlier, like what would the International Olympic Committee do? They won't go along with this. They like the peripatetic grifter life. They like traveling around the world. I just debated mano a mano a couple weeks ago, the longest serving member of the International Olympic Committee, a guy by the name of Richard Pound. He's from Canada. And when this came up, this idea of kind of having the Olympics either be in a sort of group of cities that travels around the world or anchored in one city, it was just an absolute no-go for that guy. It's just an absolute no-go. That would take all the fun out of it. It would also undercut all the possibilities for these developers. And they just have absolutely no interest in doing it.
What is their response? I mean, they don't say like, well, look, we need to be able to exploit these places to make cash. And I like to party. I mean, that's not what they say, right? I mean, they must come up with some, this is an international thing. And so is it something like that? Like, what do they say to that?
Well, I mean, if you're on the International Olympic Committee, you're pretty much a true believer. And so you believe things when you say the Olympics are a force for good, 100% force for good in the world. And so for people like Richard Pound, they're like, why would we want to limit this 100% force for good to just one city or like a handful of cities that we rotate when we could hand it to the whole world, that kind of stuff. I mean, the truth of the matter is, if you listen to that debate with him and I, basically, he argues from a position of sort of fluff and hypothesis and ideals. And I'm kind of trying to constantly tack it down to facts, actual people on the ground, how they're affected by the Olympics. And so there's this huge chasm between the way like I talk about the Olympics, because I do a ground up approach. I move to the Olympic city. I meet actual people who will never be able to afford a ticket to the games. I get their perspective and bring that into the conversation. People like Richard Pound, they're coming from above. They're coming down on the rest of us. And they just have a totally different view. They think the Olympics are a force for good. If they listened to our conversation, they'd almost think we were speaking in a foreign language.
Well, it fits perfectly into their kind of neoliberal on steroids internationalism. It's like we're going to globetrot and just completely ravage one city and then the next city. It's like this. Yeah, it's kind of a fantasy, it sounds like, for them, at least.
It's fascinating and also helpful for folks who want to push back about the potential for Olympics in their city or get involved in just the international fight to end the Olympics as we know them. Jules Boykoff, the book is No Olympians Inside the Fight Against Capitalist Megasports in Los Angeles, Tokyo, and Beyond. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, quick break, and then we'll be back in just a moment. We are back and wrapping things up. You know, that last point you made, Emma, reminded me of longtime listener of this program once told me this story that she was going to a fundraiser for a theater group in New York City. I can't remember the details. It happened probably over a decade ago. And she was sitting next to Robert Rubin, famous neoliberal economist for both the Clintons and then sadly also a
held in the Montparnasse?
No, that would have fit perfectly
in your reference earlier. Yeah,
but he was coming in. He was complaining that there was so much traffic. He was in his town car and they were driving him. And he said he called the assistant mayor and complained. But the funny part about it was that when he was talking to the mayor, he didn't know where he was. The mayor was like, where are you? And he's like, I don't know. And, you know, New York City.
Very Karen of him.
Well, New York City is a grid.
Yeah.
It's just that they're so oblivious that they can't even. It doesn't matter. There shouldn't be any traffic in New York because I'm driving through. Just a bizarre situation. Folks, that's it for us. If you're watching us on Peacock, we'll be back tomorrow. And if you're not watching us on Peacock, we will be back to now.
I do love that because, you know, it's just there's this like part of New York that they don't even. Most of how people learn the grid of the city is by taking the subway.
Well, no, and you walk or you drive. I mean, by grid of the city, I mean, like, it's literally
walk,
like, you know, First Avenue, Second Avenue, Third Avenue, Fourth Avenue, Lafayette, depending on where you are, or Park Ave, Fifth Avenue,
yes.
Madison. I mean, it's not tough. It's not tough. But the idea that, like, it's irrelevant where I am.
Although maybe he was in, like, Tribeca or Financial District, and it gets confusing down there.
Yeah, but you can also just sort of like it didn't matter. It was really just I want to complain about the traffic.
Yeah.
Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of ads, you also get the fun half. And you get to be a part of making Steven Crowder's day a little bit more depressing. That, I think...
Just our success contributes to his...
I think he's bummed.
I would imagine. I would think he's more than bummed. I think he's fairly humiliated.
I gotta say, I think Crowder rused the day he decided to pick a fight with that Ethan Klein.
Ethan, I mean, I didn't even know who he was before this. Even then, that's not saying, like, you know, any diss. I just don't follow that part of YouTube stuff. And what a legend in and of himself.
He's like he's like a Wolverine, like a Fisher King. Like, I just, like, absolutely shredded Crowder.
I mean, and he has some of the same, like, you know, inclinations that you do. In
yes.
terms of trolling and...
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. But he really, like, he bit Crowder's, like, arm off, essentially. Be that as it may,
Crowder still has his explanation. See the video for yourself.
Yes, I know. pinned on his Twitter. Look, I'm not worried about this at all. Can I get more of that out there? Let's run. They're both sort of like running as far as they can away from it.
They're so stupid, though. Like, all Crowder should have did was say, oh, I thought we were having a debate with Ethan. He backed out of it. And so there's not going to be any footage. We're going to do a different show. Like, they should have just downplayed this the whole time.
So, literally.
I'm really shocked he hasn't blocked me, Crowder, or you. I mean, I tweeted at him that you're his daddy. So
he can't. Well, I mean, we've asked for a DNA test, so we'll see.
Well, now you have to, as I said, you have to now become his manager.
He's a booking agent, too, yeah.
Yeah, he and Tim Pool and Dave Rubin, those people don't like to actually block you. They like to, like...
They need to keep an eye on
Well, because
it.
They know... Well, no, Rubin blocked me. It
Rubin
took him a long time.
Did, yeah.
Yeah, he did.
But they like to hold on to it.
I think that was part of his contract when we went over to the Blaze. He had to block me.
Had to block you.
Folks, we will head into the fun half. Just a reminder, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off.
I'm so excited. I did that, and I got a big bag of cold brew, and it's coming today.
Oh, you did? Did you do the MR25?
I did.
Oh, smart.
Yeah.
I should have gotten cold brew. Stupid.
You don't have my fancy machine that I brag about all the time.
You have a cold brew machine?
It does it. Makes it in 30 minutes.
What?
I've told you about this. It's loud, but it does, like, it spins it. It's like the best gift I've ever gotten. It's not that fancy, but it spins it, like, kind of like a vacuum situation.
Like a centrifuge.
Yeah, but Cuisinart, yeah, sort of.
It's like a centrifuge. Right. That's exactly what a centrifuge is.
But I mean, that's what I have in here every day.
You never told me this.
Cuisinart discontinued it. And I broke a piece, and I loved it so much that I bought a whole new maker just so I could get the one piece back.
Wow. I want to introduce you to something called eBay.
It was on eBay.
Oh, all right. Folks.
Yep.
There you go. Justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Also, don't forget, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And our merch is exploding. It's exploding right now.
Oh, no.
Wait, what happened?
It's not defective.
What's that?
The merchandise is not defective. It's you mean the sales.
Oh, yeah. Good point. The merchandise is not defective. Your shirt will actually not explode.
It will not burn you to death.
It will not. It will. It's just the sales are exploding. Not the actual merchandise itself.
Not one of those Samsung phone situations.
Meanwhile, Matt, what's happening in the explosive, non-defective?
Reckoning's exploding.
A lot of people talking about it.
Many people.
What's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Well, if you want to get access to what's going to be released tonight, conversation with David Griscom, myself, and Megan Day on the Socialist College in the South. Very interesting. She has a really long piece in Jacobin about this, a kind of Debsian influenced school set up in the South to help create organizers, and how it survived or didn't survive sort of civil rights and that Jim Crow South and that sort of stuff. So very interesting, in-depth discussion tonight, patreon.com/leftreckoning. That's going to be available to patrons.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
What, who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boys back. And the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives. matter?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday! My birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! Come on! Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total... Pussy, 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 pussy.